Noel O'Brien. Noel was born in Dublin, and now he resides in Camolin, County Wexford. He has worked as an actor, director, producer, and designer, and was head of drama in RTE for a period up to 1988. His first collection of poetry, Scattering Days, 21 Sonnets and Other Poems, was published by Seven Towers in 2007. So a warm round of applause for Mr. Noel O'Brien.
Thank you very much. Somebody's taller than me anyway, apparently. 21 Sonnets. I might start with some of the sonnets. The advantage of sonnets is if you're on a time limit, you know exactly how. Sonnets are going to take about 50 seconds, so you know where you are. Three sets of sonnets in which the poet does muse on love, rail at death, and ponder on what is to come. So I'll just take them, a few of them, in the order in which they're in this. First ones are obviously about the old age ones. I have no idea if I should be writing sonnets about old age. Now where go I, the decade? Now where go I, the decade that passed by? Without I knowing, the thief that men call time has stolen three more decades since my prime. Cold 70 now stares me in the eye. Old age, I'm told, has its own recompense, and yet I ask for me, where is the gain in knowing by some age it's going to rain? Or for your age, you'll break. Though locked in some obscure cells of my brain, the neurons that once triggered and then fired the longing for new beauty and desire, can by such beauty be unlocked again? But beauty now doth look the other way, and fruit once ripe, not eaten, shall decay. A bit more of the ranting in this one. Blood's red race or rapids of desire. As a crescendo in a seething symphony might go diminuendo suddenly, doth from its gushing flush and flow expire. In mist did Oisin find the land of youth, the love and fair embrace of Nice Inoid. Yet as his foot touched mortal earth once more, old age replaced the mist with planet truth. Now spare and graying hair and toothless gums were Oisin's lot, postponed inheritance. With fairy folk there is no second chance, and no woman to his bed as mate would come. Like Oisin then, with me now all is past, except to rant and rail up to the last. Oh, tell me if you can use where hast thou fled. You overtook the child in heady haste to claim the stakes of manhood, and then raced headlong through the decades without dread. Forgot how fleeting time was on the prowl, devouring hour by hour life's too short span, and snatching all that makes the man a man, that virile vigor of what once stood proud. And now the run must walk, the leap stand still, and soon the walk shall shuffle to a crawl. And all that now postpones the final call is taken once a day in one small pill. I am too well aware that life must cease, but tell me not that death's the great release. And when all the ranting and raving is done, you eventually come, skip the rest of the ranting and raving, to the last one, and so I creep into decrepitude. And these sad songs are but a lame lament for all those years misspent and time missed and mobile phones going off. And so I creep into decrepitude, and these sad songs are but a lame lament for all those wasted years and time misspent. Lost opportunity is not renewed, a talent buried is a talent lost, or like the seed that's planted in the earth, nature nurtured till the shoot bursts forth. Old age, the time when man must count the cost of all that might have been, but never was. For what is lost, now no one will refund us. Like Oscar, each man writes his debt upon us. Oh, Oscar, more than most men you have called. From out the hollow depths, here I confess, this is my voice, crying in the wilderness. Skipping on, which Tupacher called the love poem section, in this, in which the poet does recount the whims, the vagaries, and the perversity of love. now let me see. Yes. Looking out there, you're all too young. Really, if you live long enough, there will always be the one who got away, or there might have been. I think that's what this sonnet is about. Where thou the grape plucked from the finest vine, then surely I would envy he who first did touch the bloom upon thy skin and thirst to sip thee when thou wert the finest wine. If thou wert mine, then thee I'd surely store forever in the cellar of my heart, and from all common gaze keep thee apart, that none but I alone could thee adore. Planets may reign as gods in cosmic space, Olympian Jupiter and war-red Mars, Venus, god of love, and yet thy face is more divine than hers among the stars. Now I cry out, let Venus then resign, for thou art love, so ne'er thou shalt be mine. Writing lighter ones on the same theme. Probably more the vagaries and twins kind of thing. Can love that's never won be ever lost? Can love be so perverse as to deny the naked truth and tell the clothed lie? Then say I have what I have not. For love has never been bound by the rules, sees grammar and sad syntax as outworn, rejects the metaphor for oxymoron, believes that wise men are at one with fools. Love denies the grape comes from the vine, that leaves are found on trees and trees in woods. Love's reason knows no reason why it should not from the empty skin drink of the wine. Love never answers why or shows the cause, for love has ever written love or law. Then on the slightly whimsical. Tell me not that love is so perverse. Say not that love is blind, for love is kind and sees the good where others only find the evil. Love's a prayer and not a curse. Love is wondrous, daring, love doth cheer. Love is tender, caring, love benign. Love is brave and bright, and love doth shine throughout the darkest night. Love hath no fear. Love thinks of others, takes the other's pain, and yet 'tis known. Love causes deep distress, though not love's fault, I say, it's just bad breath. Yay. That's the answer. How else to explain? No, my friend, the answer is much, much worse. It is not love, but man who is perverse. On the sort of love theme, before I finish, the title of the poem is Scattering Day, and it is about the death of a loved one. But this sonnet, it's not a sonnet, it's pre-verse, it's just to show that it can actually move into pre-verse. This one is about the death of love itself. I don't normally read this in public, don't know why I'm doing it tonight. But sometimes the death of love can be more traumatic than the physical death. Again, you're all too young to have gone, but if there's anybody who's been there, this is dedicated to you. And should love die before the loved one dies, how doth love's newly widow mourn her death? On love's demise, no corpse is put to earth, no funeral pyre for signal smoke to rise, No bones remain of love, no ash to earn, nothing but the void that love once filled. Eyes are dimmed whose rays glance once thrilled, decoding speechless messages in turn. The air that stirred when love walked in is stilled, for love now holds her breath and dares not sigh. Sighs are for the one who caught the eye, and promises once made are unfulfilled, promises that two as one did share, for love doth die intestate, leave no heir.
Just finish up with two poems. Get away from that one. One of the favourite films I've seen in the past 10, 15, 20 years is a French film called Un Clair en Hiver, which is A Heart in Winter. And the theme of the film is that the heart, the winter part, the cold part of the heart, is the male part of the heart, because the theme of the film was that when women fall in love, they fall 100% in love, but that a man always keeps some part of his heart that he doesn't give. And the theme music of the film, the music of the film was, it was by, I need to get this right, it was Ravel's trio, and the producer, the director of the film, Claude Sauté, said that the trios are much more deeply emotional than the orchestral music. So this is why he took, also the team of the film was a sort of menage a trois, so there were three people in the team. So this is the second last poem, and then I will read just the title poem about the scattering of the ashes of a loved one. So this is called Claude Sauté. It's written as if it were a letter to the director on things from Un Clair en Hiver, Heart of Winter. Excuse me. My dear Monsieur Sauté, may I call you Claude, dare I, mon ami? I have seen your film Un Clair en Hiver at the Lighthouse, Middle Abbey Street. Your film on love, your manager Swan, Maxime Stéphane Camille. This was how the French made films, when the French made the fucking films, which would part my French code. Before the days of Betty Blue or some Oscar Mère Nouveau, Un Clair en Hiver is the kind of film you want to see over and over, not because you have forgotten, but because you have remembered how good it was, not like Betty Blue, which I've seen twice, such a bore, Claude, I only remembered I've seen it before, when the two in the bed. A man whose name I have forgotten, and Betty Blue started screwing in a wide shot with the camera tracking in, and I knew by the snail slow pace of the track that getting to the orgasm was going to take forever, because there was no way that little whore was going to come until the camera was on top of her. That's the man in the bed whose name I have forgotten. But you're a film on a name, yeah, I call you on a name. Your film on love, your manager, Antoine Maxime Stéphane Camille, your film Claude and Maurice Ravel. Ravel's sonatas and the trio for piano, violin and cello, but not the bolero, no. The bolero is all right if you are looking at Bozell's Eric Bunkin, that little shite, W. Moore in hell. But the sonatas, mon ami, may I call you mon ami? The sound of the sonatas that cuts deep into the dark heart of the heart. The scalpel sound that opens up the heart where you and I have been but do not dare lay bare, because we have looked and we have seen winter. But not women, Claude. Not women. A woman's breast and a woman, Claude. A woman, she will dare. And just finally now. About scattering the ashes of love. It's also about men are fascinated with women's makeup. They don't admit it, but they actually have no idea what it's all for. And I came across all of her makeup after she died, and that's really what triggered the poem. Days and was it week? Days or was it week? Chronology had gone astray. After you died, I found a sachet of your time to find it care. Positive action number 7 between your moisturizing body lotion and the blonde glow glisten spray. Heaven knows time was not defined. Death stole a march on you on April 27, 2001, and heeded not the care you took with those defiant lips that needed not such care once we could share a kiss. Time defined its care, positive action number 7, hypoallergenic, anti-feathering, an aging curve, to hydrate, plump, and firm, I bet the sashy blurb. Oh, you could be firm all right, defiant one. I have seen you give lip to many a fool who thought of bettering you. But now those lips are silent, still. No more time to find free, unfettered from this life, as if you ever held your tongue. Oh, the irony of it all, defiant one. I scatter your ashes from Tara Hill on a blustery summer day, it hits like rain. I can never trust the bloody weather. A gust whips up your weathering dust, another swirl and dust returns. A few grains fall upon my lips, final parting kiss. Oh, the final form. You always have the last word.
You are brilliant. Thank you very much. Our next poet is a novelist, poet, and playwright from Dublin. He has had poems, short stories, and literary critical articles published in various magazines. His first two novels, The Death of Finn and 10 Short Novels by Arthur Kruger, were published by Seven Towers in 2006. Could we please welcome Mr. Aaron Ryan.
Good evening, everyone. I'd like to read you a piece called Don Quixote has been promoted. So it's a story set in the future about one of my favorite literary person's characters, Don Quixote de la Mancha. Desert, 2999. In these times, as the earth is deserted and the last of us shipped off world, heroes, a grown lad, then set free to roam the earth, to inspire the few million left to the last city. But Rocinante, Don Quixote's horse, can't stand it anymore. Tired of the talk shows, the cryogenic spaces, daytime television and the steroids, Rocinante finally escapes into the desert and hangs out there for weeks, rediscovering the direction of her life after the madness of being with Don Quixote. But her peace doesn't last long. Even in the desert, there are rumors. The winds and the shifting sands whisper of Quixote's promotion, and Rocinante gets lonely. There comes a time when a horse begins to miss its master, and its master's extreme foolishness. It gets so lonely, and goes in search of company. But Don Quixote is gone, and she is lost. He is nowhere to be found. Rocinante tries to retrace her steps. Nothing. Rumors abound about Don Quixote. Rocinante goes back to the wasteland with food and a little water, but that soon runs out. Exhausted and dehydrated, she finds a rocky pool and goes there to drink. At the rocky pool, Rocinante sees dead corpse propped against a rock. Rocinante stumbles into shade and falls at the body's feet, smelling water. Rocinante buries her dried out snout in the clear, cool water that the rocky oasis and drinks. The dead corpse smiles and says, "Hello. Hello, Rocinante. Hello, dead corpse." I imagine that's quite a relief. The water, cool water, crystal clear. Yes, Rocinante answers. Wonderful to taste it. Clear water, once again. To taste it, clear as an azure, wonderful, as I said. How long have you been here? Rosinante's eyes adjust to the light and she sees dead corpse clearly. She is horrified at the sight of the rapidly decomposing, still animated body.
Jeez, you look terrible. What the hell happened to you?
I am dead, says dead corpse. Not sure of the exact metaphysical or medical details. Something about a virus lying here 3 days, being eaten by vultures. My little friend can't feel a thing. Tell me, bad day at the office perhaps? How is your life? Not good. I've had a bad day. I miss Pidote. I spend my time wandering alone now across the plains. One gets lonely, but the news is so bad I can't believe what's happened. Dead corpse strains to look up out of the one eye he has left and saying something akin to a grim smile. Nothing but heat and light around here. Looking out at the vast expanse of this old planet in who knows where, the great endless blue of sky, the night wind and the blazing light, that of the odd craft landing. Rosinante whinnies in sorrow, chews a few dates and thinks deeply about the state of affairs. Bad day. Bad news. Very bad news, she says. Tell me, Rosinante, there are so few to gossip with now. What's the news? What's the bad news? The Queen of Spain is dead? Another of Cervantes' novels ejected? Another Inquisition? Has Spain been invaded? Rosinante looks at the dead corpse with a compassion that surprised him and says, I have travelled for days from corporate headquarters to escape, if you will, to reevaluate, and I hear the worst news imaginable. Has the virus returned? Maybe it will kill me again. What have they discovered about me? Nothing. Don Quixote has been promoted. That is the news. Catastrophe, Dead Corpse says. They sit in silence for hours. Neither can think of anything to say. Evening falls. The vultures continue to tear at the flesh of Dead Corpse. Doesn't that hurt, Dead Corpse? I mean, there's so little flesh left. No, not really. Can't feel a thing. Lucky thing. Don't frighten them away. It puts off the inevitable, my little friend. Say hello. Tell me how. So I take it, the corporation promoted Don Quixote. Correct. Right. That's my understanding. To what? Rosinante shooed a few vultures away, but they fly back again. There have been rumors, my dead friend. All I hear are rumors in the rumor mill. I came out here to endure the silence of the open spaces. I can take no more talk. Nobody knows anything. There will, I am sure, be an announcement. The craft will hover overhead and beam the news into this great dust bowl, but nothing outside the last city. I'm sure they will, my fine friend. There must have been facts behind it all. Something on the grapevine, olive grove, state tree. Something understood but unspoken. They're always watching, gathering data, making reasoned decisions, working out the next move. They have the situation in hand. Everything is under control. They have the situation in hand. They bought the desert. Good for space movies. You'll see a tourist soon, believe me. I was a tourist once, you know, said Dead Corpse, trying to stop his head from falling forward. No muscle left, you'll see. Rosinante grimaced, squeezed, and turned his head away, seeing the great wind pick up at the distance. They say he was going to give up chivalry for the next movie. I see. Less of a credibility gap then. Don Quixote was offered an option in public relations, offered a huge 10-figure contract, worth a fortune, options and points. He has contacts everywhere. He built it up on his travels. He was signing contracts all the time. That's why I left him. I see. Tell me, who brought about the promotion of Don Quixote? Sancho Panza. I see. And how did the Honorable Sancho Panza do this terrible thing? By the power of illusion, by the mystery of words spoken to confuse. It is said that the decision was based on Don Quixote's record, years of dedicated customer-oriented labor, resourcefulness, a tireless instinct for timely intervention in the most sensitive situations. What do you believe, my friend Rocinante? I must confess, therefore, that all this talk messes with my head. I mean, look at you. I can't allow the vultures to feed on your body. It's sick and horrible. It's wrong. There'll be nothing left of you soon. Calm down, okay? I caught a nasty virus once from an unwashed. So very innocently, simply, the plague found me waiting. My body grew weak and I failed in my duty. I came out here to the corporate-owned emptiness to die. After I died, I came back to life. And I watched from this watering hole the vultures gather and the tourists photograph. One of them sat behind me as his partner took a photograph of us. I thanked them for their company. And they ran off in horror and phoned unsolved mysteries. After my flesh is gone, I will cease to exist. At least in the world, that is my destiny. So what do you believe about your fate? Does this fate not trouble you, dead corpse? And why should it? After I am no more, I will go to another higher, better, happier, dead corpse-free life where death and destruction are no more. But I won't bore you with the propaganda. I am open to new ideas. What do you believe, Rosamante? I believe that everything one believes that exists is the truth. I believe that the truth is nameless. I believe that Don Quixote is no ordinary fool. I believe his madness is gone, has been replaced by trivial common sense. I believe his passion is gone, that madness replaced by mere decision. No longer does he quote from the ancient chivalrous tales where I and I traveled alone. He no longer declares his love for the beautiful Dulcia del Toboso. He thinks she is an illusion. He acts like the old Don Quixote, only in the company of directors or the really literate corporate thinkers. He's only looking for money or a spot on primetime television. Those who can endorse his immortality. Yes, Cervantes was duped into writing all those volumes. All his enemies were illusions. All those hilarious adventures, all the clowning of the divine stupidity, those fortunate meetings with Panza, the Sierra Morena, the Black Mountain, the curious person. Everything to make immortal the wonderful Don Quixote. You see, my dead companion, I was confused, upset. I came out here to think it out. They are looking for me. My mobile phone keeps buzzing. Can't seem to bring myself to part with it. What's the matter? Dead corpse comes forward silent. Rocinante looks at him. Dead corpse, she thinks, has gone to a better place. The vultures are gone, looking for someone else to sign a contract with corporate headquarters. They turn away to see that the night is nearly over. Dawnlight. Rocinante sits by the rocky pool, looking at the tourists. The phone keeps ringing. Eventually she will answer it. Time to go, she thinks. Time to fill up her flask with water and seek the eminently sound Don Quixote and chide him for his promotion.
Hi, Ryan. Thank you very much, Ryan. Our next reader is a poet originally from Oklahoma. He began writing poetry seriously in New York, and his metrical style is evocative of that city. His first collection, A Shot Rang Out, will be published by Seven Towers in 2008. And can you please give a welcome to Mr. Quincy Flair.
The holiday season. Though you can drink, you cannot smoke in bars. As livers rot, the lungs remain pristine, and like the excommunicates, we lurk out in the streets. The cherry beacons flare for every unbeliever in a chat. But health is given, and pleasure hardly counts when paired with nicotine and dewed with cowards. Though you can drink, you cannot smoke in bars. The crime is down. The subways smell like piss and beggars form like weevils on the track. Their faces turn indignant in the night, their voices creak, not strong, but vehement. You may be good, but can't stay innocent when the rent is high, the checking balance low, and others' needs get used to a hit. The crime is down. The subway smells like piss. Though yet a name, a creature sets to strike that murmurs in the workings of a drunk whose face is half a shudder, half a sneer. Behind the eyes, but see the suited hack who blithely makes the case for cutting back. Just look around, his fingers ball in fits, and in the end, we all know what it's like. Though yet a name, a creature sets to strike. So, in light of my agent's introduction of the New York Post, fortunately I selected a fair number of urban paranoia poems. I was going to read the Down at the Farm cycle, but maybe some other time. It's all just a work. An urban yokel flat jaw yawn came belching from behind the teeth. The curses of graffiti scrawl while grits of garbage spread beneath the train like shrapnel. Just past dawn, commuters winced at the subway's scrawl while powdered sugar caked the sleeve and the caffeine kicked in. Time to leave. The train ride ended in the walk. The crowded offices was fast. The blinking screens and new accounts of someone else's money. Past the back and forth of aimless talk and shuffling of the screen's mouth. The crowds were settling to a hush an hour beyond the sugar rush. The pitch was weak, but the ball's in play for the 5-day week and the 8-hour day. For the 2-week trip to some distant land and a big fat tip from the cash in hand. And in the evening, clammy sweat clung like cologne to pallid flesh cooked gray by fellow lights and doors. A change of clothes and all was fresh or something like it. But the sweat of thwarted yearning leaked through pores and spoiled that briefly polished air a new shirt short debonair. She felt no better. And her face relaxed in mute acceptance, bit the faded lipstick of a smirk, as if to stop a laughing fit, and forced itself back into place. She muttered, "Well, it's all just work." Then settled on an absent grin with mouth locked tight and eyes since then. Your joints will creak and your eyes will say that the flesh is weak, but the soul's okay. So the tongue will trip, and the words you plan jumble up and slip like a groping hand. False alarm. It's just a noise, you said as I woke up, cursing softly at the muffled yelling across the alley. Just a noise, you said. But had I heard a woman's voice so faintly calling out help? And though no sounds of struggle or shrieking sirens followed, I was caught, awake beside you, an edgy sentinel marking out perimeters with my hearing, plotting individual jurisdictions, spheres of influence, I guess, the point at which the problem lay with someone else. You looked at me and said, "Go back to sleep." Still, I twisted the sheets around my toes, seething at the silence that revealed no resolution. Just a hint of plot. A false alarm? Perhaps. The very quiet, though, suggest the dark hypothesis and falsifiable from where I lay. As if by chance. When I looked at her, and when her lips pulled back to show her teeth, and when her voice broke into laughter, I could only think of moments that I pissed away. Each choice I'd left to others in the careless slips that landed me beside an empty drink. That afternoon, I could have sworn I saw a fair, hopeful version of my face staring from behind her retina. Familiar, yes. The eyes, the skin, the jaw, but in that instant, somehow out of place. It cast a known frown. The gravitas was overbearing. Nonetheless, we filled the void with gossip, anecdotes, and smut, comparing chatty journals note by note. Like poets, we dissembled in the rut that each of us was in, our chances killed by loss of nerve or failure to emote. But still, a sneer could not have hurt me more than that clear laugh that sang of expectations, so long forgotten from a distant day when youth still spread before me, and the poor and pitiful attempts at explanation still lay in ambush, only years away. This is a blank verse sonnet about death. Last call. Sometimes the last call goes unheard, one sip left of a lukewarm beer. And when the lights shoot tracers as they flash to get you out, you wonder what comes next. There's always home wherever that is. For the moment, though, you're blinking at an empty glass, your head beginning to emerge in surging throbs from the last drink you got. It's what you knew was waiting from the moment you arrived. Part of the drill. The point of the exercise. The pain, the numbness, hardly worth the breath it takes to curse the boundless dark outside. Only offset slightly by the light that clock like smokers near a ballroom door. And finally, not at all pretentiously titled, Why There Is No Socialism in the United States of America. Oh. At 4:15 a.m., the city bus had pulled up to the curb, its silhouette marked dimly by the light that crept through grace, sensing an empty store. I paid my fare and squeezed beside a sleepy Barnard girl. She moved a centimeter to her left, away from me, and twitched a pinkish nose below gray, narrowed eyes, accusing me of something. So I leaned against the glass and stared at greasy, distant streets of light. Each one of us was tired, pissed off, and bored, angry with the hour and with those pricks, that fat-ass bitch who muttered at a cell phone, that rat-faced airline worker at the front, that punk-ass hoodlum staring at his feet, that stuck-up twat, that sad-eyed brown-haired schmuck gawking at New York's pre-dawn backlit blackness. And if we were united, our disdain for every dumb shit creep, in short, ourselves, had fused our isolations into one.
Quincy and I met about a year and a half ago in Dublin, and we painted the town red between us. So I'm glad you're still painting the town red. Thanks very much, Quincy. We had six poets originally lined up for tonight. That's mine, actually. That's very right. And we're down to four, and then suddenly went up to five again. That's why I'm reading the fifth, or the fourth, the fifth of the Peter Brown head again. Mr. Conor Farrell, welcome, Conor. We didn't actually meet, but welcome very much. He's a Dublin writer, filmmaker, and musician. On September 12, 2001, Connor and his partner started out on a tour of the world. And their experience was initially of meeting the aftermath of September the 11th. And Connor's book, September the 12th, is really about that and his whole trip of the world during that year. And Connor's going to read some of that for us now. Welcome, Connor. Thanks.
It's just part of the work in progress, and it's the piece I want to read is just essentially reflections on, you know, our reasoning for wanting to go traveling in the first place. On September 12, 2001, we took a cab from Heathrow Airport to the Indian Embassy. And the taxi driver had made a remark, seemingly throwaway remark, that the world would never be the same again. And this kind of inspired me to start journaling our trip around the world. The world will never be the same again. The taxi driver's words weighed heavy on me for some reason. I didn't doubt him necessarily. And in a sense, it was hard not to get caught up in the words given the apocalyptic atmosphere that day. The London I saw was like a ghost town. I had never seen nor expect to see it that way again. People were genuinely shocked. For some reason, I had expected chaos in Heathrow that morning, but instead was greeted with a semi-vacant airport filled with semi-vacant people. Security didn't seem particularly tight that day. Or maybe it was just that we were expecting something just short of a full body search. It seemed to me as if security tightened as we moved around the world. Our next stop was India, and by the time we were leaving Mumbai Airport, we were taking our shoes off and having batteries removed from our personal stereo. The taxi driver had asked me, why India? At that moment, I wasn't even sure why I wanted to travel at all. The sparkle that had once emanated from all things travel-related had ceased for me. I was 30 years old, and the magic dust that had covered everything in my youth had disappeared. The days had lost their colour. What was left was a sense of uncertainty and gloom, and I had no idea why. But I wasn't going to rest until I found it. As far as I knew, it was nothing to do with age. I was very happy about turning 30. I didn't like being 29. When I was 29, I had a distinct feeling that I was hurtling towards something. When I turned 30, I felt that I was gone from being something 9 to something 0. It was like being given a fresh, clean slate. It would be convenient for me to say at this point that this was the reason I wanted to undertake this trip. A fresh start, a new beginning, etc. But that wouldn't really explain anything. And at the same time, it's not entirely inaccurate either. The truth is, there wasn't a singular reason for my desire to travel. I suppose there was something of the adventure in me from an early age. I loved mystery stories. I was always looking for a bigger world. I grew up beside a small wooded area which the children locally referred to elaborately as the forest. At the end of the forest was an ominous 6-foot brick wall. Behind this wall was the extensive grounds of an old mansion house. Behind this wall was the biggest orchard known to man. Some of the older boys used to raid the orchard, but they had to watch out for Paddy the caretaker. He had an awful temper. If he caught you, he'd skin you alive. And he was allegedly a bit strange, a bit peculiar, a bit queer. Beyond the orchards was contra land and bamboo land. I never knew anybody directly with being, but everybody knew of somebody, generally an older brother, who had been to these mystical places. But a visit to contra land or bamboo land was very dangerous. There was more than just Paddy the caretaker to contend with. There were skinheads, or members of the gang known as the Dragons, or worse, drug addicts. Nobody knew or asked what a drug addict was, but it was generally accepted that they were to be feared and avoided at all costs. Behind this wall lay mysteries. But child will find mysteries everywhere, and I was no exception. I found them on family holidays and trips to the countryside. I found them beyond the trees at the end of Granny's backyard, where a pack of spooky feral cats lived. Of course, The real magic of my childhood lay in mysteries and not in the revealed. As I grew up, these mysteries started to fall away one by one. Also, sadly, I refused to see them anymore. The most earth-shattering thing that happened to me as a child was losing my father to cancer at the age of 9. Actually, I was 9 years, 6 months, and 5 days. It was a terrible. What did it all mean? This was a mystery to me, but one that threatened to destroy all the magic for good. Thankfully, I was granted a gentle reprieve, and childhood returned before it was too late. I had no idea how or why, nor did I have the inclination to question. All I knew was that I was able to salvage some magic for years to come. I simply have to believe in mysteries. My somewhat paradoxical belief was that life was meaningless without me. Traveling to distant countries around the world just seemed like a natural progression for me. Another one of the main reasons I wanted to travel was because I could. When I was a teenager, some friends of mine went to work abroad for the summer. Some went to London, some went to Germany. When they returned, there was always a story. I loved to listen to their stories. They seemed very worldly to me. I wanted stories of my own. It would have been around this time that my oldest brother had traveled Europe by interrail for 2 whole months. When he returned, he came back with a piece of the Berlin Wall and stories of partying in Paris and Prague, island hopping and sleeping on rooftops in Greece. I was impressed. I would have been impressed at the time if anyone had told me these stories, but in my book, anything my older brother did was cool. By the time I was in college, I was intrigued by the idea of traveling around Europe by rail. Some of my friends had gone into rail, and I still had only made it as far as London. As soon as college broke up for the summer, I headed off with a friend around Europe for what would become my first taste of backpacking. Carla was unwittingly no stranger to travel and adventure by the time I met her. In fact, she was already quite the adventurer by the tender age of 3 months, having emigrated to no less than 2 different countries on 2 different continents. Tragedy struck early in her life, when at the age of 2 months, her mother died. Neglected and undernourished, she was brought from her home in the Silver Hills of Tegucigalpa, Honduras, to the city hospital, by a mysterious hombre who donned a hook in place of his right hand. It was here that a visiting young nurse from County Clare saw and fell instantly in love with the child. Against the hospital's advice, the young Irish woman adopted the dying infant and brought her back to her husband and their home in Montreal. 2 years later, the family returned to Dublin where Carla grew up. When I laid eyes on Carla for the first time, I thought her mother must have been a Mayan princess and her father a handsome Spanish conquistador. She had inherited her mother's beautiful full lips and her father's flashing eyes. Soon after our relationship started, Carla brought me back to Honduras to meet her family. This was an altogether different travel experience for me. It wasn't like traveling around Europe. There was poverty, the likes of which I had never seen before. This was a whole new experience for me, and amongst other things, it made me think about all the places I ever wanted to visit. To this day, that list is growing, but I decided that I would make a start in the coming years. We made one more trip back to Honduras 3 years later in April 2000, before finally going to trail finders and booking a ticket around the world. When preparing to travel to our first destination, India, I tried to find that special something between the pages of Kipling's Kin, but couldn't seem to recapture any of that sense of adventure at all. In another vain attempt, I also dug up a dusty old paperback containing extracts of the Bhagavad Gita. I picked this up on Grafton Street some years earlier after being accosted by a grinning young Hare Krishna man. I've seen this guy many times around the world. He was around my own age, which at the time was early 20s, and he seemed to be in a perpetual state of bliss. I remember being very intrigued by him, probably as a jealous of his apparent rapture. In our ensuing conversation, I repeated, "Yeah, but how do you actually know?" The piper I was starting to annoy myself, but this didn't seem to deter him from his enthusiasm. He was still smiling as I walked down Grafton Street, clutching his literature under my arm. But there was something knowing in his eyes, and for that reason I couldn't wait to get home to find out the secret of happiness. I don't specifically remember reading or attempting to read the book, but when I looked for it years later in the days prior to our trip, it was buried so deep under piles of books that I imagine it hadn't received much attention, the my first abandoned tent the day I brought it home. But some 8 years had passed since then, a lot of water under the bridge. Nathan knowledge had eluded me then, but in the days prior to our departure, I wondered if I was finally ready to be enlightened. I dusted off the cover depicting the Lord Krishna, a blue but strangely beautiful deity. I started to read all about warriors, gods, and demons. I read about Arjuna and Krishna on the brink of a great war. But at this point, I found it hard to reconcile Arjuna's great battle with my journey ahead. In desperation, I turned to Asperger's Gandhi, and finally, as my cultural aspirations declined, to Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, the company had a takeaway curry. Although, to be fair, by the time we were going to India, I'd read up as much as I could from the guidebook. You can only read so much in preparation for a trip such as this one. My initial plan was to devour as much travel literature on the main countries that we'd intended to visit, but it didn't work out that way. We researched our first destination well, then made vague plans for moving on without holding ourselves to anything. This generally worked very well. Invariably, though, we met travellers on the way who gave their 10 cents worth of information on places they had come from, and this often determined a lot of our decisions for our next destination. We rarely, if at all, argued over where to go. Most of the places that we visited in each country was on the recommendation of fellow travellers, and we in turn soon delighted in becoming distributors of the unofficial travellers' word-of-mouth information bureau. If there was somewhere that one of us really wanted to go, the other was less keen, then we would generally go there anyway. We were very much aware that this whole experience was very significant in the context of our personal history, and therefore we attached much importance to our choices. At one point, we debated whether or not to visit Chiang Mai in North Thailand, near the Burmese-Laos borders. We wanted to go hill tracking there until an English girl we met in Koh Samui complained that the city was overrun with rabid dogs. Fortunately, after much debating, we decided to go, despite not having any shots for rabies. I don't remember rabid dogs, but I do remember our charismatic guy Jungle Joe and all the friends we made in the hills of Chiang Mai. Early on in the trip, we decided to head for Goa, India's smallest state. However, it was the bustling fishing village of Talangoot that I had in mind, and not its smaller, more attractive neighbour, Bagger, to which Carla thankfully directed our rickshaw. It was here that we met Lakshmi, who was just reluctantly entering into an arranged marriage. It was here that we rented a bike from Nanu that almost proved fatal after we crashed during monsoon-style rain. We followed signs, we followed recommendations, and we followed our good instinct around the world. I often look back and wonder about the places we almost didn't make it to. What if Hebrews has been less consistent about some of the places we really wanted to go to? Or what about the places we almost made it to, but for some reason or other didn't? We had planned to go to Papua New Guinea, Mexico, and Guatemala, for example, but never made it. Surely this would have changed our trip immeasurably and for the better. Unfortunately, limited funds or time restrictions prevented us from going to these places at the time. But had we gone, would it have been at the expense of some other more valuable experience? There are no answers to these questions, of course. But some of our experiences was based on many, many choices. Choosing to do and choosing not to do. That's the journey. That's life. The rest is a mystery. Thank you.
Very much, Connor, and I guess that's the Maya princess sitting there next to you. Might get a poem about it, but Princess Maker, so great. Thank you. Our next poet was born in Wellington, New Zealand, but has lived in Ireland since 1990. He has had many varied jobs and currently works as a civil servant. His first collection of poetry, The Gentle Art of Rotting, was published by Seven Towers in 2006. Could we please welcome Mr. Ross Hathaway?
Right, I'll read a few poems, but they're mostly short. Here I can joke pretty easy. The first is, it's about loss in a way, loss for a population. It's My sister lived in Cardiff for a few years, and we would go over there. And one time we went on a tour of the Ronza Valley, including going down the mine. And it always stayed with me how anybody or how any population could fight for their right to go coal mining. It was the worst job that there has ever been anywhere. But then loss is loss, and it's not always easy to see that loss if you're outside that, whether someone's building a dam and flooding your valley, or whether the dam breaks and you lose 100 years of lifestyle. And this is called After the Dam Broke. We are no longer still water people, but still water people for all that has gone, dripping off the years of anger and doubt and flood and loss, love and blood and pain, and then the years of drought, for all that we stand for, standing still, 40 feet above the water, still 4 feet above where the water used to be. Right, just to show that I have massive literary connections, I once shared a flat with a friend of the great New Zealand novelist Elizabeth Knox, and I had a very small part in her first novel because they were all female and nobody seemed to know how to drive. I had to explain the difference in a draft text between a handbrake turn and a wheel spin, as is the way. It never made it into the published edition, but still that's my part of literary history. But the book was about a central theme of New Zealand's common cultural history, which is war. We'll go and fight anyone anywhere, it would seem, if we read our history. But not so much war as the return, the experience of the returned soldier, a young man or woman who goes somewhere else on what seems like a big adventure, and should they survive, they come back damaged in ways which aren't apparent, to a place which may or may not be what they thought they were fighting for. And this was inspired by that first novel, After Dead Hour, and it's called Crossing the Saddle. The land is craters and lumps the eye. Vision lifts with ghosts and husks of men. Mist thickens trenches and ridges ground our waiting senses. Trees hanging every breath. Left, our women linger. Futures torn and choices shorn by loss and nationhood. A terrible century. What remains is released home over the saddle. We emerge to a stained time, stumble, washed and stiffly, sympathy the mist we live in. The land itself is steep and clean, a lean religion, a cradle from the grave. Right, this is the only time I've ever done any research for it. Poets don't have to do research. We interpret the facts rather than follow them. But it was a long time ago. I researched jazz terminology. So I'm sure that all the words are correct. I just don't know what they mean anymore. But I don't really like to write love poems. I write left behind poems, left someone else behind poems. Really regretted that poem. This is a kind of left behind poem and it's called Rag for the Left. To syncopate, to play your mind and eye socket, jelly roll to jazz to steal tears, down on cymbal cheeks, tin pan alley tap and tapping, tapping and a brushing with death and death and the snare drum rattle. The picture is mine in my head, cause when you do 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 right by me, I can let you die, you see, you live in my mind, my shouts, my fears, and I can still smell you after all these years, and if you were dead instead, it would be better than hearing you're alone. facing into, we've got a Kerry man here, and I'm seeing most people are from Cork, into a gladiatorial contest in September, and then the real sport, the Rugby World Cup, coming up. It may be timely to look at this entirely serious and well-researched essay on masculinity, called the First Law of Rambotics, and it was inspired by someone I knew who had a lingering disease, a young man, and like all good young Kiwi men, refused in any way to discuss it or his emotions and discuss everything else. Called the First Law of Rambotics. Remember the movie Drive? Hume's dry, reflective vision of trailing flicker and glory. Remember of the greater Western steaming on our screens, the flagpole fervor, John Wayne cooking beans, the movie name, could it, is it, will be, Chew Grit, or the other one, the other outstanding strand and spaghetti highlight, I think, the lone dog ranger facing, alone, the angry town, a fist full of collars, and then, stare at it, the news broken, facts arrived, a star dead, died, was killed by Rambo side. The headline, which never looked back, muscles flex and crunch on chest. He continues. This, I think, yes, this our boy who dragged tears, real seen tears from the legion's frontispiece men, the man who walked alone into the League of Mothers annual convention, the birthplace of the nation, and there received a standing ovation, is dead, son and product of this approval's searing national obligation. That's about the longest one. Okay, the title poem, The Gentle Art of Rotting, is a tribute to that noblest of trades, the one which allows human beings who aren't very good at digesting anything to digest first-class protein, because these are butchers, and these are the people who let our meat rot enough for us to cook and eat it. The gentle art of rotting has built us, yet stands lost to all but a small cadre of the gifted. The trade is a bloody smear, journeyman's flights a minor insult, but this is the worst of abuse. The butcher of, you name a troubled spot in this rotten world, fairly unfair for men who whistle at work the world. I've known a few in their time, no better or worse, if redder and better fed, cleaner running than most, their generous empires, with pride we find in things well done, a jointed beauty, a rare beast. There are graces we fall between. This is solid grace for a better world. If I could whistle, I might have been one. I lived in Alice Springs in Central Australia for 2 years, which was at the time I arrived there, at the time of the Australian bicentenary, which has had all the historical validity of any of these sort of things. The Western Aranda people, one of the people living in Central Australia, had been there for about 25,000 years. Didn't think 200 years was really worth celebrating. But it's also the oldest continuous water course in the world, and usually it's up that flows underground, but the day I arrived, they had 9 inches of rain in our springs, and so it was fairly wet, but it dried up pretty quickly, and this is about that. It's called Spink River, Hermannsburg, 1988. The celebration is on the coast. Here I stand in the middle of a riverbed, 40 million years deep. This land that is owned and not owned in 10 minutes owns me. The land doesn't need me, but the river's hands hold my feet. The heart of the land is red, the mouth of the land a the empiricist. An empiricist is somebody who measures outcomes or experiences. May or not be me, I don't know. But sometimes it's like this. I want to wake and make all my women happy, dance like a drain and laugh in the sink, sing up a trance and people the park, find all our places in the beautiful dark. And sometimes it's smack down a well shaft, ribboned with razor blades, skin slices trailing, pain on the stair, face down and flayed in acid mud and rubble, turn to the light and I die. Okay, this one does have a few jokes in it. I've got to say, and Quincy would be with me on this, that this is about one of the defining traits of the Irish nation and something which the rest of the world doesn't always understand. But when I've read this, sometimes people thought, what's he talking about? It's called What It Is To Be Late. Is a delicate understanding of loss and betrayal is to add purpose to a journey, to regret change but rush to the new thing, an uncrushable belief in the compression of time and distance, a symphony of hope and resignation, in front of life, but behind the clock of approval and expectation, beyond health, bedridden and bad habits, a core example to the young, to the weak, to us all, tied up, tied down and lost in town. Still kicking, but dead, finally, irrevocably, incontrovertibly late. Okay, here's my party piece. Lots of jokes here. Alright. My hearing is not the best in industrial deafness, so the background noise. The human speech range is pretty muffled. So I developed this in conjunction with Seven Towers as the Seven Towers Guide to Lip Reading. Reading lips, writing lips, speaking lips, signing lips, using lips, lip use, lip service, paying lip service, paying for lip service lips. Service lips, in-service lips, self-service lips. These lips would have done some service for the state. Lip ego, lip id, lipidity, lipid lowering agent, lip lowering agent, lower lips, upper lips, the lips that dare not speak their name, hounded lips, rounded lips, eclipse of the sun, the moon, the world lips, people lips, worker lips, supporting the cause of international labia, fraternity, equality, liberty. Equal lips, equivalent lips, ambivalent lips, lip rejection, never lips, nether lips, leather lips, crack lips, bird lips, chat lips, smack lips, thick lips, thin lips, stick lips, lipstick, lip, lick, lick lips, a lip of the tongue, a Freudian emphasis. Slip lips, clip lips, purse lips, curse lips, apocalypse. Now and again, damned from lips to eternity. Painted lips, sainted lips, church lips, chapel lizard lips, leech lips, lip or rock, Arkansas, lip of ages, lip of faith, lip of the Arctic. Lip of the yarn, polyps, coral, nasal, intestinal, nether lips, red lips, cred lips, the lips formerly known as prints. Billets, full lips, bare lips, beer lips, the lips that cheer but do not intimidate, lips that have touched alcohol but still won't touch mine, missed lips, kissed lips, nearly kissed lips,
wish we'd kissed lips, wish we didn't, passing like lips in the night, dream lips, young lips, the interpretation of lips, lip interpreter, lip reader. Well done, you are now reading lips. Yes, I mean, if I found someone younger to read that, it's pretty demanding. Something that, when I first started reading, or taking poetry seriously and reading it, I was with a friend of mine in Wellington called Michael Eager in the mid-1980s, and we had a tradition of offering a gift to the audience, their patients, that would be somebody else's poem that they mightn't have heard of, but as far as possible, a very different voice from our own. And tonight's gift is from the New Zealand poet Bill Manhire, who was also an Old English scholar. And this is his version of an Old English song called Wolf, which is a love song, a very sad song. They take it from me in the manner of a gift. If danger moves in the earth, is the life given, is it love between us? Wolf, on that island, I on this other, shut into fens, a bone in the neck of a savage. If danger moves upon water, is the life given, is it love between us? In my mind we joined together, as it rained, as I was sad in the rain, as he laid me with his arms, into his shoulder, a joy given into me like sorrow. Wolf, wolf, it is not at all hunger shaking my limbs, but that you do not journey, absent and yet you fill me. They take it from me in the manner of a gift, the spine of a feather, a cloud in the body. Aye, it is easily broken, what was never at one. You and I, Wolf, the one with the other, and singing. Thank you very much.